Welcome, I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On this show, we spend a lot of time talking about the problems of our current economic system. The growing inequality in the distribution of wealth, the lack of good jobs for average workers, the shift of the burden for health care and other social needs onto families and workers, not to mention the gradual disintegration of our ecosystem under the pressure of a globalized, growth-first economy. And quite often, as in the conversation we had with journalist Hedrick Smith on Tuesday, the answer to these deep problems is organize. Band together as citizens to pressure lawmakers, organize as workers to demand more of employers. Our guest today, Gar Alperovitz, is deeply critical of the current economic system. But he's also skeptical that the traditional call to organize is going to change an economy that systemically works against the interests of workers, communities, and the environment. In his new book, What Then Must We Do? Straight Talk About the Next American Revolution, Alperovitz challenges liberals and radicals alike to reassess their strategies for change and focus on what he calls evolutionary reconstruction of the economy through the democratization of wealth. In his book, he says when you start looking, you can find examples of that reconstruction just about anywhere in the country. 130 million Americans are members of some form of cooperative, from groceries and credit unions to retail co-ops like REI or Ace Hardware. Worker-owned businesses and so-called social enterprises that generate revenue and serve the community are growing, and more states are allowing for the creation of an alternative kind of corporation that takes into account a social bottom line as well as the interests of shareholders. Alperovitz also says that preparing on the local and state level now may allow us to make national change in the future when the crises that are inevitable in our system come along. So if you are part of that alternative economy, if you're in a worker-owned company or participate in a cooperative, do you see them as having the power to change the system from the bottom up? And if you're one of those organizers who works in a labor union or is out there trying to make citizen change, what do you think of Gar Alperovitz's analysis and where he thinks we're headed? We want to have you join the conversation. The number to call, 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. And also just say, given the scale of the crisis that we are facing, economic and ecological, can we wait for evolutionary reconstruction? You can also send emails to feedback@yourcallradio.org or post a comment at yourcallradio.org. Gar Alperovitz, thanks so much for joining us here in the studio for Your Call.
Thanks for having me.
I should just let folks know you are a political economist, a historian. You're a professor of political economy at the University of Maryland, and you are also a founding principal of the University of Maryland-based Democracy Collaborative, which is a research institution developing paths toward ecologically sustainable, community-oriented change in the democratization of wealth, which is the subject of your new book. And I want to let folks know that Gar will be speaking tonight at St. John's Presbyterian Church in Berkeley at 7:30 p.m. All the details and how you can get tickets are at our website, yourcallradio.org. So, Gar, thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Let's just start where your book starts, which is talking about changing a system, what it takes to think systemically, and how you think kind of the liberal-left dialogue about the economy has come to a bit of a dead end and needs to start thinking about some alternatives. What's not working, and what do we need to reconsider?
First, let me say, I'll take whatever we can get through traditional means, through organizing, through labor unions, wherever that's possible, more power to it. And I've come out of that tradition of progressive politics of that kind. But, you know, people, when you know that there's a real problem is when you look at the big, long, long trends. So labor, for instance, has gone, although it's increasing in California, around the country it's gone from 35% of the labor force, 34.3 at the peak, 1953. It's now down in the 11% range membership, and going in the private sector, it's down to 6.6. So the muscle, the institutional muscle behind traditional liberalism, and I've worked a lot in liberal politics and progressive politics, the truth is, around the world, progressive solutions did largely depend on labor, and that is declining in this country and around the world. So either we develop another institutional base. You need a movement that's political and activist and confrontational. But we also need an institutional base. And what's really interesting is we're beginning to see socialization of capital in what is a co-op. That's a small-scale, traditional changing the ownership, democratizing ownership. We're seeing worker-owned companies, popping up. We're seeing worker-owned companies as well as co-ops, different kinds of worker-owned companies. There are 11 million people working in so-called ESOPs, employee stock ownership plans, worker-owned companies that are becoming even more democratized over time. They've had a lot of problems in the past, but that's another element. And almost everywhere in the country, we're seeing land turned over to nonprofit corporations that benefit the community. Now, all of this looks kind of scattered if you're in one of them, but if you take kind of overview, there's something been building up for 30 years as the pain's been increasing around the country that has some real power to it.
I really want to get to what you talk about. You talk about this kind of evolutionary reconstruction, this checkerboard approach to making change and thinking about it. But before we do that, I want to just take a moment to talk about those traditional means of making change and why you think that perhaps in today's context they won't work. I mean, I think a lot of folks, I say we had Hedrick Smith on Tuesday, and he was really talking about we need to, you know, strengthen unions, we need to think about worker organizing, and we need to kind of do the kind of citizen activism, say like a Ralph Nader is well known for, really organizing folks to put pressure on Washington, D.C. to make a different kind of economy and to put the people of power out there again that was there, say, in the 30s or in the 60s when people look at that. Why do you think that's not likely to be a successful first approach?
Well, two things. One, I come out of that tradition, and I've known Nader for 40 years, and we worked with him when he started, and when I was working in the Senate. And I used to run House and Senate staffs for progressive congressmen, Gaylord Nelson, the founder of Earth Day. I was his legislative director. So I'm in that tradition and know quite a lot about it and have spent a lot of my life in it. When you look at it, I mentioned the trends of radical decline in organizing labor around the world, and it's being undercut. So unions are, although in some states, very few exceptions, California being one of them, that's not true. But in most states around the country, there are radical decline, and very few people believe there will be a shift back up. We've always had a relatively weak labor movement, 34.5% at the peak. The Swedes were at 85% of the labor force unionized. Most countries was much more powerful. Ours has always been relatively weak. It's in decay. You can say a lot of the labor movement increase in the 1930s had to do with the, quote, accident of the Depression. Before the Depression, labor was at 11%. The Depression allowed us to move to 26% of the labor force. World War II, another kind of historic kind of accident in a sense. It's not a regular norm. We probably will never see a world war of that kind because of nuclear weapons. Boosted labor to 35%. And it has been steadily down ever since. We're back at the 1929 level as we go away from these kind of momentous Depression and World War II kind of events in the post-war period. So I don't think anybody that I've, any expert or even activists or organizers believe the labor movement will grow to the extent it once was, although I would certainly back that. But I don't think that's going to happen, which means that the pain levels are going to continue. The old liberal solutions, it's 30 years of long trends. It isn't just about the kind of Republican blocking right now or the Tea Party. Distribution of income has gone south for 30 years, and that's reflecting these long trends. The top 1% has taken from 10% of the income to 22 to 24%, depends which year you look at it. I mean, you have to think about it. This is why it's a systemic crisis, not just an ordinary political crisis. The top 1% has taken literally all of the gains of the economic system over the last 30 years. I mean, it's an incredible thing to think about. And then if you look in other areas, for instance, incarceration rates, they've gone steadily up. You want to talk about liberty, civil liberties? Look at how many people are put in prison. We are eight times as bad about this number, and the trend has increased eight times as bad as any other country, including Russia in the advanced world. The long, long trends on ecology and 30% increase of CO2 over time. Look at those long trends, and you know, and you face them directly, you know you're in a systemic crisis. Not the kind of political crisis that we can just bounce back with a little countervailing power.
So these are long, troubling trends, which most of our listeners, I think, are pretty familiar with on one level of detail or another. What do you see that you really identify? I mean, you said, we were talking before the program, you said, I'm not so much an advocate for the change that I'm seeing that I'm encouraged by. I'm seeing something happening that runs against those trends. But it's what you call a checkerboard kind of change. What are you seeing? Give us a sense of some of the signs you think that are encouraging of some kind of alternative.
The first starting point is you know, and most people know, systems are driven by who gets to own the wealth. And, you know, the top 400 own more wealth. I mean, this is a staggering number. More wealth in the United States than the bottom 180 million. So if you want to change the system, one of the many things you're going to have to do, besides a lot of organizing protests, et cetera, you're going to have to change who owns the wealth. And how does that happen? And can you do it in institutions that aren't overly centralized, like the old Soviet state and so forth? Well, what's happening out of the pain, and the press just doesn't cover this. They can't afford to cover it. They don't care. They're not assigning people to do it. You are finding around the country thousands and thousands of new developments because people are in great pain. Worker-owned co-ops are growing. Neighborhood corporations, where the neighborhood owns some wealth, land usually, land trust, which is another form of neighborhood, and city ownership of land. It's another way to hold wealth. That's building up. Many states are considering putting together banks that are state-owned, like the Bank of North Dakota, been sitting there 90 years. It's a socialist bank, if you like. And there are 20 states that have been considering legislation over the last 4 years to set up these banks. Probably Washington and Oregon will be the first ones. So if you look actually below the surface, not so much because people are advocating, although that's important now to begin advocating, and that's also happening, but because they're dead-ended on the old strategy.
It's filling a need.
Filling a need. Dead-end on the old strategies. The pain is increasing, and people say either we roll up our sleeves and try something new, or the pain goes on. And that's what's really interesting about it, because it's driven by these long, painful trends and driven by the fact that the old kind of liberal solutions just aren't doing it and will not do it in almost all certainty because labor is so weak, and that's key to the liberal solutions. But this is building up. Now, remember, I'm a historian. I'm interested in the development decade by decade. It's like the end of the 19th century. How did we get slowly, steadily build up the preconditions of the progressive movement? How did the women build up the, you know, step by step, state by agonizing state in the 19th century until they got the vote nationally, state by state by state? So I'm interested in the prehistory of the New Deal, all the things happening in the so-called laboratories of democracy, state and local, where nobody was watching. But the things that became the New Deal were developing and evolving principles that became national later. That's what I think is happening. And the key idea here is changing who gets to own wealth, which is a system-changing idea if it continues.
Gar Alperovitz's new book is What Then Must We Do? Straight Talk About the Next American Revolution. I love that idea of trying to think about our historical moment, not just in relationship to the past, but to the future. What might we come before? What might be developing now that could set the stage for some change in the future? And I want to invite our listeners, people who are feeling the pain, having that sense of frustration with the solutions that have been offered up, not providing answers or making change. The number to call is 866-798-8255. Are you interested? Do you find some hope in some of these alternatives that Gar Alperovitz is seeing happen on a small scale, local and state level? 866-798-TALK. Also want to encourage folks who are involved in these efforts, whether it's a land trust or a co-op, a credit union, if you see those alternative efforts, do you see them as being able to change this system? We had an email from someone who said, I hope you'll mention the communities directory at ic.org. It lists co-housing communities, communes, eco-villages, housing co-ops, other types of intentional communities. We have posted that at yourcallradio.org. And if you're someone who's involved in any of those efforts, please join the conversation. Gar, go ahead.
That's a really interesting example. I've been going around the country with this book, What Then Must We Do? And almost every place I go, we get dozens of call-ins or listings of things that nobody's been covering in the press, just like this caller sent us an email. So the press doesn't have the capacity to cover it, and that's one reason I wrote the book, to just kind of display what's really happening on the ground that isn't being covered and is building up step by step around the country, partly out of intention, wanting a new direction, partly out of pain of great difficulty and that you need to do something new or the pain continues.
I guess one question that I would have about some of those alternatives you're talking about, is their ability to get big,
right,
to scale and make a difference? Because, I mean, what's on the business page? You're talking about companies with hundreds of billions of dollars in cash. How do these small efforts have a chance of changing the big economy?
Well, the small efforts need to be built up, but obviously if it doesn't go to scale, then these are just sidebar issues. And going to scale is partly political. At some point, applying these principles at much higher scale, like the Mondragon corporations in the Basque country of Spain, which is a huge 85,000-person cooperative that many people now are beginning to understand. It's in all high-tech industry, large-scale, competing successfully in the European economy. It's got a 6-to-1 ratio of top to bottom in 85% of the jobs. And in the big, big part of it, it's
6 to 1 in terms of what people are paid.
Well, they're paid compared with 3 or 4, you know, 2 to 3, sometimes 400 to 1, top to bottom in American corporations. And at the peak, just part of it, the very biggest part of it, these integrated co-ops, Mondragon co-ops, it's 8 to 9 to 1. That's the top compared, again, with 300 to 1 in American corporations. So we know what can be done by these. And the Mondragon idea is all over the country now. But there are also examples in the United States. For instance, in Ohio now, there are examples that have grown up out of the experience step by step in Ohio. There's a lot of history to that, which I was involved in with the steelworkers back in 1977, trying to do things that they projected taking over the big steel mill. Well, that gave people a lot of ideas in Ohio, but now you find, and I could go through the history of that time, but in the city of Cleveland, this is in a very poor neighborhood, 40,000 size neighborhood, 40% unemployment, average family income 18,000, largely black, very difficult neighborhood. But right in the middle of that are hospitals and universities, Case Western Reserve, Cleveland Clinic, University Hospital. And as you think about this, almost every city's got this. There's a lot of taxpayer money in those hospitals, Medicare, Medicaid, education money. Well, there's a group of people growing out of the Ohio experience that have put together very large-scale worker-owned cooperatives in that area, linked together with a revolving fund so that they refinance more and more and more of them, and that's the idea, to grow, and all linked together so that some of the money made is going to community services. But, for instance, scale. The largest urban greenhouse in the United States is worker-owned in this area, part of this complex. By large, I mean 3 million, with an M, heads of lettuce a year. I've just learned that requires you to plant 26,000 every single day. So that's part of it. It's a worker-owned co-op. There's a large-scale industrial laundry serving the hospitals and universities in this complex. And then a solar installation company online to put in more solar installation than exists in the entire state of Ohio. And many other cities are beginning to kind of look into this. Atlanta, Pittsburgh, the Washington, D.C. area, all are developing something like this model. And you can think about it this way. That's largely taxpayer money. Why shouldn't it help stabilize the community, build new ownership forms in large scale? They buy, you know, $3 billion, these big hospitals and universities, with a B, $3 billion in that area. None of it spent there. Now they're beginning to spend and serve that way. So you see a sector that can expand in a much more dramatic way than some of the smaller scale, building on their experience.
So I want to hear from listeners about their thoughts about these ideas, whether they think they can make an impact, if they're involved in them. We have a caller at 866-798-TALK. It's Brian in San Francisco. Welcome, Brian.
Hi. Thanks. It's a wonderful topic for the show. I'm involved with a forum called the Green Labor Capital Forum, which organizes people to talk about using labor's capital in the form of public employee pension funds and private employee pension funds to invest in green jobs, clean tech, and grow the economy with labor's capital. Here in San Francisco, there's a network called The Hub, which is promoting B corporations and social enterprises. My question is this. I agree that we should both work on traditional forms like expanding organized labor and new forms of businesses, and I don't think they're mutually exclusive. I believe that labor could organize associations and cooperatives and expand their ranks, and that would strengthen social businesses or social enterprises, because it would give, they were organized by SEIU or UFCW, that would give them the strength of these million-strong labor unions, plus they would have the power of the, they would, you know, have more input on the direction through their, through the union, on the social enterprises, the social businesses, and the cooperatives,
Brian,
and associations.
I think I understand that how labor could actually work to be part of bolstering these efforts.
Yeah, I totally agree. And again, here's another example. You've just around the country, that's a new example of what you've just said of what's happening here. But and I totally agree with the idea. And in fact, if you look closely, the steelworkers are actually doing this now as a matter of strategy. the steelworkers used to be totally against worker ownership, and I ran into that when I worked with the Youngstown locals. The International was trying to kill worker ownership. Now the steelworkers are leading the fight for worker-owned co-ops with unions in them. That's the notion, and they're promoting them in Cincinnati and in Pittsburgh in particular, two experiments going on. SEIU is also beginning to experiment with laundry in Pittsburgh. So we're beginning to see some interest in this, and I think that direction, using labor's muscle, but not just to do experiments. We need experiments now, but beginning to think, where would we go if we were serious over the next couple decades and think of ourselves historically developing a whole new direction as the pain continues and as the old ways fail? That's where I think the action is, kind of raising our sights to what this could be if we continue to build a power, just as the reader, as the speaker just said, the call-in. There are really interesting possibilities when you get creative about it.
Well, but the thing is, when it comes to any of these efforts, the resources, human and otherwise, aren't unlimited. You have to make some choices about what you emphasize, and you're really arguing this should be something that folks who want to see change in the economy or who are feeling that pain should make a priority.
It should make, and also realize that they can do this, because if you can do it in a city like Cleveland in a neighborhood of 40,000 with 40% unemployment, you can do this almost anywhere, particularly these big universities and hospitals. They are anchored there. They're not going to move, and they could become the basis, along with kind of union pension funds, investing in these kinds of strategies. There are openings around the country, and the bottom line is transforming who gets to own wealth in the system. If you don't do that, you don't get at the power base.
I want to go to Cheryl in Santa Cruz, who's calling in, talking about changing the question of pay in corporations. Cheryl, welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me. Thanks for bringing this whole topic up. I used to work in media in New York and was involved in Wall Street sort of efforts on some level. And I love the way corporations have a typical 300-to-1 top-to-bottom pay ratio. You know, they talk so much about how investors make demands and we have to listen to our investors. Well, you know, much of these people who are suffering under this 300-to-1 ratio are owners in these companies as well. And I wish there was a way, and I'm going to try to work on it as I get back into the workforce, but a way to galvanize, you know, the power of these investors who essentially, according to their executives, run those corporations, make demands of those corporations. So between that, and also I just think tax relief for the wealthiest, I know it's been talked about and beaten to shreds. I'm not going to let it go until something happens, because for 400 people to own as much wealth as the bottom 180 million is disgusting. And I don't know how many co-ops it would take to break that, but I think it has to come from both ends.
Thanks so much, Cheryl. Garth, you could be brief. We have a break in a moment.
I totally agree. It's got to come from both ends. The Chinese have a phrase, you got to walk on both legs, the traditional as far as we can go, but you've got to transform the power base, which is wealth. And I think that's what's emerging as a real possibility. Also, there are lots of, you know, kind of public-minded investors, social investing, and this is another discovery. They are beginning to invest in these worker-owned co-ops and new projects who, you know, are kind of disgusted as well with the direction that's been taken and have some money that they want to help out the direction. That's another part of the phenomena as people really look at where we're going with these long trends. Publicly-minded investors with a little money are beginning to look at this as well. So that's another kind of development not to pay attention to.
Gar Alperovitz is author of What Then Must We Do? Straight Talk About the Next American Revolution. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. Encourage you to join this conversation if you're someone who's involved in some of these alternative economic efforts, or if you're hearing about some of them for the first time, why do you think they don't get the coverage, the attention that they might deserve? And do they offer a real alternative to some of these really frightening long-term trends that Gar Alperovitz and obviously a lot of other folks who join our conversation here on Your Call week in and week out have identified? We'll be back right after this.
This is Your Call. You're on Local Public Radio. To join in today's conversation, the number to call is 866-798-8255. Or you can send us an email question or comment. The inbox address is feedback@yourcallradio.org. Programming here on KALW is also supported in part by An Evening with David Sedaris. He'll be appearing at San Francisco's War Memorial Opera House Sunday, May the 5th, for an evening of all new readings and recollections. Tickets and information at davidsedarisontour.com.
For those of you joining us now, I'm Matt Martin sitting in for Rose Aguilar. This is Your Call. We do podcast the show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up next. Tomorrow, we're going to be having our weekly media roundtable. And on Monday, we're going to revisit a conversation about youth mentorship programs. Today, we're talking about making a just and sustainable economy and where you start, what the priority should be for making that happen. We're talking to Gar Alperovitz, author of What Then Must We Do? Straight talk about the next American Revolution. And I want to let folks in the Bay Area know that Gar is going to be speaking about his book tonight at 7:30 p.m. at St. John's Presbyterian Church, 2727 College Avenue in Berkeley. All the details and how you get tickets are at our website, yourcallradio.org. Gar, I want to pick up on a bit of the conversation there, both from what Brian and also Cheryl were saying before the break, talking about kind of the choices that whether it's a pension plan for a union or individual investors make about where they direct their capital. There's been a lot of talk about kind of socially responsible investing. But I think that you're kind of pointing to something different than kind of putting screens on it to make sure that your investment isn't going to tobacco or the military, but it's another kind of intentional way of directing that capital.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with the attempting to use screens in investing and try to move funds out of the military, not of, you know, tobacco, et cetera, and the many others. Fine. But what's really interesting is if we're going to develop a whole new transforming the ownership of wealth into institutions like co-ops, worker-owned companies, we haven't talked about city ownership, et cetera, utilities, there's going to be need for capital. One source is the credit unions. The credit unions taken together have more wealth in them than one of the big banks in New York, any of the big banks. And there's a movement to democratize, use some of that as well. But individual investors are also beginning to band together and have woken up to this possibility. There's so-called social investing or impact investing, lots of different terms. People willing to take a more reasonable return or more modest return in order to advance different forms of ownership, ecological change, new projects of that kind, they are also beginning to band together. SOCAP, which is one of the organizations, which is big. I spoke last year in San Francisco here at their conference. There were 1,700 people there. These are big operations. Social Venture Network is another very important grouping, and they're meeting in San Diego this weekend. I'll be down there as well. People willing to invest and looking for ways to do transformative change also are part of this puzzle. So we're looking at really interesting times when people are kind of looking around, realizing it's got to be a different way. We'll do whatever we can the old ways and try to pass legislation, take what we can get. But developing new ownership forms, new strategies, that's another challenge, and people are beginning to wake up to it.
You know, you mentioned the potential power of, say, credit unions. It's a cooperative form of economic organization. But I venture to say most people who belong to a credit union, keep their money that way, don't think of it in those terms. They may think of it as like a more positive community-oriented alternative to big banks.
Right.
But they don't actually think of it as something they might participate in democratically.
Yeah, not only that, most credit unions are pretty kind of bureaucratic and kind of staid and boring operations that are doing, you know, their loans for housing and housing. There it is. They got more money. These are one person, one vote banks. That's really something to pay attention to. And they could be using this to build this movement. So in some parts of the country, I was out in Vermont about a year ago, they have actively realized that these institutions are people's institutions. And they've begun to, if you go to the annual meeting, and sometimes they don't advertise it because they don't want you to know about the annual meeting, but they must tell you, nobody's there. However, if you bring your friends, join them, become part of the members and begin moving, you can actually begin to elect people to the board, as they've done in Vermont. And these are one person, there's huge amounts of capital, some part of which could be used for funding and developing what we're talking about. That's also on the radar for developing a new strategy that changes the ownership of wealth and capital.
I want to go to calls in just a moment, but I would ask, I mean, is part of the issue, though, when things grow larger, that bureaucratization, that distance that comes between the people who participate in it and the people who are running it on a day-to-day basis, becomes, it's hard to maintain that sense of involvement, whether it's representative democracy or a credit union.
It is harder. But in fact, we're seeing that's what's interesting about the unions, like steelworkers, calling for worker-owned co-ops with unions in them. So, and that's the same thing as the Mondragon, this big, complex, very successful worker-owned, 85,000 people worker-owned co-ops, lots of them, also have the equivalent of a union within. They call it the social committee, but it works like a union. So we're beginning to see complex strategies. It's not just simple co-ops. We're beginning to see people think through what does it take to deal with larger scale. And that's part of the, you know, again, this is evolutionary stuff. Pain is driving people to this. It's like the prehistory of the progressive era, step by step learning and getting political about it. Most of this is not yet political, but much of it's beginning to get a political edge. The mayor of Cleveland, who is kind of helping with this big complex in Cleveland, looks pretty good. And people are beginning to realize there's a political side to this that might be built up as well. Over time, laying groundwork, laying foundations, ultimately for something much more advanced, in my view.
I want to bring on Julie in Oakland. Julie, welcome to your call.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah.
Go ahead. You're on the air.
Well, first, real quick, I just wanted to appreciate the mentions of Pittsburgh. It's a great town. I lived there for many years, incredible labor history, and rich in social capital. My particular comment was about community-supported agriculture, or CSAs, and I was wondering if that fit into the concepts that your guest was talking about. Myself, I belong to a produce CSA that is an organization of immigrant and small farmers providing produce, as well as a meat CSA. So that allows me as an apartment dweller who doesn't have room for a big freezer to have a share of grass-fed, sustainably raised meat once a month, as well as the produce. And I couldn't afford organic produce and grass-fed meat without that. So that's, you know, made a difference to me anyway. And so that fits in with, like, being driven by, you know, an economic necessity, I guess. But it does seem like the interest in sustainable agriculture is really growing, and this might be a gateway into other forms of cooperative organization, possibly.
Julie, we'd definitely get a response from Gar about this. We have a related call about just about agriculture and its role. Thank you so much for the call, Julie, from Bob in Mill Valley. Bob, welcome to the program.
Hi. What I wanted to advocate for was a kind of new language around work. I feel like a lot of the problems that have come out of our economy has been people following kind of a get-everything mining type model, you know, cut down all the trees, take all the fish, get all the money, and do it all at once, as opposed to what was more a classically agricultural way of doing work, which was, you know, long-term planting and growing. And I think that we're reaching a point where so many people aren't on farms and are now in cities that there needs to be some kind of education to people about treating work more as a sustainable thing, as opposed to, you know, get in it, get everything you can, and move on. I don't know if that makes sense, but that's kind of what I'm thinking.
Bob, really interesting. Julie talking about agriculture very concretely. Bob more metaphorically saying this is a model for thinking about work. Gar Alperovitz, what do you think?
I think both are absolutely right and absolutely really important. The term, the new economy movement, is kind of the language that covers this changing ownership, but also the ecological vision and also a different way of thinking about this. Thinking about community is really what this is about, and thinking about work as part of a community vision and changing how, and I think the metaphor of agriculture is right. You don't just drive both the soil and the individuals to death. You kind of look at this as how do we build an ecological vision as part and parcel of this transformation? And I think that, but going beyond what often has been the CSA model, which is kind of separate from the larger movement building, ultimately political model, and going beyond the ecological vision and looking at the whole system, we're facing a systemic crisis. And I think if we're going to get anywhere, it's going to involve both the themes that the two callers mentioned, but also seeing this as how do we build a transformative movement over the next couple decades that also takes on who gets to own the capital. Otherwise, we'll be marginal small projects on the sidelines, rather than step by step seeing ourselves as laying groundwork step by step for something much bigger. And I think that's what's at stake in all this. And that's why I wrote this book.
And I want to invite listeners to join the conversation at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. If you're involved in these kind of new economy efforts, on the local level, or if you have a national vision about them and you're interested in taking part in this conversation with Gar Alperovitz, please give us a ring at 866-798-8255. And if you work in the conventional economy, if you're somebody who maybe is feeling the squeeze either as someone who's unemployed or as someone who's seeing wages and benefits stagnate or decline, do these alternatives seem like they have real potential to you? What questions do you have about how they might work and how they might grow beyond that patchwork that Gar Alperovitz talks about? You can also send us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org. One of the things, interesting things that you talk about, and actually we have an email from a listener who says, her name is Leslie, she says, I'm afraid that what's happening in the state laboratories, now there's this, if you say, for example, Michigan, Virginia, the other states that Republicans swept into office to in 2010, is a teapot takeover. Horrendous unconstitutional laws that contain provisions preventing Democratic reversal. But she says, I'm open to Gar Alperovitz's ideas. I've been reading him for a long time and, you know, want to know what you think. But so you talk about the kind of Democratic potential for the economy at the local level. She's saying, well, you know, a lot of that's going the other direction as well.
I absolutely agree. But, you know, the argument of what then must we do is that we're in a long fight. And if you look at the kind of what's going on, it's like a checkerboard. You can point to lots of things that are going negative. It's very easy in many states. On the other hand, and those are the black or red parts of the checkerboard. On the other hand, in many states, there have been reversals. So, for instance, there are states where you're getting the most obvious one, where there are really interesting examples of what can be built up over time. The negative states, I think, are going to find themselves in real trouble as they create more and more pain by what they're doing. And if you see this as long term, that pain itself is beginning to generate reactions. So I think the negative states, if you like, on the checkerboard have got to face that they're doing things that are going to get a lot of people angry and get upset. On the other hand, there are interesting things happening positively that we can build on. So, for instance, the Bank of North Dakota, the socialized bank that's been sitting there, 20 other states are looking to do that. They've had legislation introduced and beginning to show a different direction. Washington and Oregon are probably the most advanced. A whole other sector we haven't even mentioned yet has to do with health care. Health care is almost 20% of the economy. It's a big deal. Well, the health system as a whole is in crisis, and it's beginning, the pain is going to increase as some of the companies begin saying, I'll take the penalties and get rid of the health insurance, and then people are going to feel what that means. So, and the cost pressures are building up. Several states are beginning to say, let's take over the health insurance system. So Vermont is going to do that now. Connecticut's on the verge. It was passed single payer, which is public ownership of an insurance company. That's what Medicare is, public insurance or state insurance. You in California, you passed it twice. It was vetoed by Schwarzenegger. But the future is not over. I think you're going to see that coming around. And you begin to get public ownership of the health system and some of the banks in some of the squares on the checkerboard, even as the reactionary squares increase pain and begin to see the reaction to that. You know, this is not a tomorrow fight one day. The next decade is what we're talking about, and beyond that, I think I see hope coming out of this, and a lot of it driven by the fact that there's growing pain and the old traditional solutions aren't working, so people are being forced to innovate. And when we get intentional about it, and that's why I wrote What Then Must We Do, get intentional and begin moving it into politics, because there's a lot that's building we can build upon. That's the argument. It's time for us to get intentional about where we want to go and changing who gets to own the wealth.
You know, when you talk about people innovating in reaction to pain, it sounds like a very market, what to a lot of people might sound like market-based solution, right? Communities will come up with, you know, we don't need to have a government that's going to guide things. We're going to, you know, let people figure out what's wrong at the local level and figure that out. I mean, are these ideas you see actually reaching outside of the kind of left liberal perspective into some, you know, what might otherwise be these Tea Party folks?
Well, there's several parts of that. I mean, you said market-based, or you might have called it Marxist-based. Who gets to own the capital?
You tell me.
Who gets to own the capital that comes out of pain? It was a traditional socialist idea, but ended up with a statism like Soviet Union that nobody wants. This is very down-home American.
But I think that the right in this country has claimed those kind of ideas.
Indeed, that's what's really interesting. Because at the national level, you get these crazy ideologues largely on the radio or in the Senate. But if you go to a city like Cleveland, or I was in Atlanta recently, people who call themselves conservatives sometimes actually are interested in small-scale developments and supportive. We're finding small businessmen want to help out. They think it makes sense to begin building. The workers should own. Why not if it's practical? That's the most important single thing that I've learned in writing this book. If it's practical and makes sense, you find strange allies at building up at the local level and the state level. What they turn off on is large-scale rhetoric, but seeing what can be done, we get volunteers who are retired businessmen want to help. And I think if they asked, if you pressed them, they'd say, I'm a conservative. I'm not sure. But they certainly are doing things that are very different from what traditional conservatives talk about.
I want to welcome Alicia in Santa Cruz to the conversation with Gar Alperovitz. Welcome, Alicia.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I was interested to read about a gentleman who was proposing changes to the language, the legal language that drives shareholders to include environmental concerns, social justice concerns as part of what is included in the bottom line, because as it stands now, the shareholders, the bottom line is what drives businesses' goals, and there may be people who don't want to just mine the system for money, but if they're working for a business that's concerned about the shareholders and their voice in it, unless that's changed, I just wonder where the movement is on that. That seems like a really critical, crucial piece, that if the shareholders are driving it, we're not really going to get anywhere. So I will take your comment off there.
Gar, a different way of thinking about corporations. Thank you, Alicia.
Well, it's critical because, Wall Street, first, I'm going to be down in Santa Cruz on May 30th, so maybe we'll see you, Alicia. But the corporations, large-scale corporations and their investors, have got to increase their quarterly returns. Otherwise, they'll get killed by Wall Street and most of the big investors. So changing ownership is really critical. Ultimately, down the line, if you're interested in the question of can we get to a non-growth economy or can we start getting serious solutions on climate change, the problem you need to face down the line is that big corporations must grow. They have to, or they'll get slaughtered at Wall Street. So some of them clearly at some point have to be turned into public utilities if you're going to change that underlying logic step by step. But again, the critical question is how do we think of ourselves as building a movement that changes the idea about ownership in a very American down-home localist build-up only when you need to regional or national level. And over time, people don't do that. We think too quickly. It's time to begin to stand back and say, look, my heroes, and I've written this in the last book, my heroes are the civil rights workers in Mississippi in the 1930s and 40s who laid the groundwork at great risk. Many of them were, slaughtered and tortured, and laid the groundwork decade by decade for what came in the 60s. I think that's where we are with this whole new economy developmental process of changing ownership. There's a lot going on, and very heroic people are beginning to see themselves historically as laying groundwork for a much larger change, even as the pain continues. And I think that's the perspective of the book, What Then Must We Do?
And what then must we do? Straight talk about the next American Revolution. That's Gar Alperovitz's new book. And we welcome you to join the conversation with Gar at 866-798-8255-866-798-TALK. And that's just what Robin Sambruno has done. Rob, welcome to the program.
Hi, yes. As much as we can, let's do a project right now. Okay, I got a school. It's running dirty diesel buses, and we want to convert those to electric buses and using solar on the school roof. Let's do that. How do we do that?
What would you say to Rob? He wants to make a change right where he is.
How do you do that? What I think is critical is people around the country are facing that. Here's a website for you, www.community-wealth.org. And it surveys projects around the country, mostly on changing ownership, but also a lot of other related projects. The first step is to get more information on what somebody else around the country has already done. And what you're going to find is that people are into this kind of change. And it's not being covered by the press. You'll find, you know, 30 years ago, if you wanted to set up a worker-owned company, it was very hard to find an expert who could tell you how. My judgment on what you're raising is that you will find dozens of people around the country who've actually begun to do what you're talking about, and that's the place to turn. That's what a movement is about. It's beginning building knowledge as well as projects.
Gar, I wanted to ask you, we had a listener who called in who said, you know, when you talk about cooperatives, a lot of people across this country, basically, that's one of those ideas they put in that big socialist bag that they have a very, you know, negative reaction to. And I would add to that, in your book, you talk later in the book about nationalization.
Right.
One of those other ideas that, of course, unless it comes from, say, Goldman Sachs, we consider, oh, well, that's too far out left for America. First, how do you deal with that? And then tell us a little bit about how nationalization, from your perspective, might fit in what we'll see in the future.
Well, look, the we do nationalize all the time. I don't know if you noticed, but we nationalize General Motors, Chrysler, and AIG, the biggest insurance company in the world. We just did that a couple of years ago and put a lot of taxpayer money into it. And then, you know, okay, we'll give it back. At some point down the line, public ownership of big corporations and utilities is very common around the world. I write about it. You know, the press doesn't cover it, but it's very common. They're very efficient. In most countries, they beat the you know, Harvard Business Review is writing about this, but the press doesn't cover it. I think down the line at some point we're going to get wise that you can have public enterprise in an economy and make it work. But we do nationalize, and my prediction would be the kinds of crises that forced us to nationalize General Motors, Chrysler, and AIG, and de facto put enough capital into the big banks that, in fact, they were nationalized, though we didn't say that. And in fact, we had enough money, we could have turned it into stock. Those kind of crises are not going to go away. And down the line, at some point, we're going to say, can we use these for public purposes if the taxpayer is paying for it? Now, on the word, you know, the word socialism is really also interesting. There have been three polls recently, and they all show that people under 30, and these are the people who are going to build the new economy over time, people under 30, if you ask them, do you like capitalism or do you like socialism? Which term do you like better? By and large, the movement is slightly more favorable to socialism, believe it or not, than to capitalism. So that's a really interesting finding.
I can believe that in the last few years, capitalism's positives may have dropped a little bit. That wouldn't be surprising.
But socialism's positive. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the term has lost, the tiger's lost its big teeth, I think. And that term is kind of, who cares about the language? And people slightly like it better. So call him a socialist. Who cares?
Well, that's another question. So we were talking about this kind of nationalization, the really big picture. But what about small business and the kind of, you know, here in the Bay Area, Northern California, there's been a lot of emphasis on let's buy local.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, are small businesses basically the incubator for the capitalism that we have, is there some way of doing them, people interacting with them, that is more of an alternative?
Well, I mentioned this big Cleveland development where there's worker ownership and so forth. That's supported by small business, not opposed. Again, contrary to all the images you have in your mind about the small business that are going to be against this. At the local level, if it's practical, you find small businessmen indeed volunteering to help. And also, if you look at the economics of it, these kinds of developments improve the local economy, more customers for small businessmen. Small business is not the enemy. They're being clobbered by the system as well. And there's a way, in many ways, to reach out, and I think in parts of it. There's an organization called Business Alliance for Local Living Economies, BALI, and it really brings together small business people interested in building the community, supportive of co-ops, ecologically oriented. So that's another piece of this growing new economy movement that it is beginning to take on real power and force over time.
That is Gar Alperovitz. He's the author of What Then Must We Do? Straight Talk About the Next American Revolution. I want to let folks know that Gar is going to be speaking tonight in Berkeley at the First Presbyterian Church. You can find all the details at our website, yourcallradio.org. And also, coming up later in May and at the beginning of June, he's going to be in Santa Cruz, San Rafael, and back here in San Francisco. All of that information will be posted at our website, yourcallradio.org. I want to thank folks who have taken part in the conversation. And I also just wanted to ask, but before we go, Gar, because we're coming to the end of the conversation, it's gone a lot of different directions. Where do people who say, okay, they aren't already participating in something like this,
what should they, you know, where might they plug into? We had a listener who said, hey, you know, I'm 60. I'm having a tough time finding a job in the economy as it is. I'd like to maybe start a worker-owned enterprise, or I'd like to do something, you know, starting where I am.
Right.
How do people start doing that who maybe already aren't involved?
Well, that's a really good question. One of the problems is that the traditional press doesn't cover what we're talking about. They don't have the money to do it. They don't have the interest to do it. And they don't have the reporters to do it. And they don't really care. So that's why most people don't know this explosion that's going on around the country. So let me give you a website. Obviously, the book, What Then Must We Do, tries to cover it and give you kind of across the board.
And I will say you also have a DVD coming out. We have a nice trailer from that that's at our website, yourcallradio.org, if people want to check that out or share it.
Yeah, there's a DVD on this as well. But here's a website, www.community-wealth.org or .com, either way. And it simply brings together whatever we could find, websites that cover worker-owned land trusts, neighborhood corporations. There are people who know about each of the little sectors and bigger sectors that we're talking about in some depth. And www.community-wealth.org or .com is a survey of it's a place to go for more information about what you can do and what other people are doing.
We just have about 30 seconds. Are there important policy changes that need to happen to make this kind of development possible?
Ultimately, there are policies that flow from this. For instance, more public purchasing to help these kinds of corporations, like to help small business, can help co-ops and development, funding banks, public co-op banks. We have a co-op bank that could get more capital. Lots of policy changes can be built into this. Ultimately, building this direction is a political movement, which means policy. But the question is, we can do things now, building towards that time.
Gar Alperovitz, author of What Then Must We Do. You can find more information about him, his appearances around Northern California, at our website, yourcallradio.org. Gar, great to talk with you. Really important conversation.
Great. Thank you for having me.
I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. This is Your Call. Thanks to everybody who took part in today's conversation. On the next Your Call, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. 1 week after the capture of alleged Boston Marathon bomber Dzhokhar Tsarnaev, we'll talk about the full range of coverage, from the manhunt that closed down Boston to the claims and counterclaims about enemy combatants and connections between the bombers and international terror. As you've watched these events unfold, what have you learned about our media and our country? Join the conversation at 10 or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. It's Your Call with Malihei Razazan and you.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihei Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco, with special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz.